Okay, let's unpack this. We've got a fascinating set of sources here, all centered around a single golf tournament, the 1980 US Open. Our mission today is to cut through the details and pull out the absolute must-know nuggets about this championship that make it such a legendary event.
That's right. We're diving deep into the sources you've shared, which chronicle this specific championship at Baltusrol, giving us the key players, the course itself, the drama as it unfolded, and the lasting ripples it sent through the world of golf.
All right, let's set the stage then. The venue was Baltusrol Golf Club, the lower course.
Hallowed ground in golf history, really, an A.W. Tillinghast design.
Yeah, and it had already hosted majors, right? US Opens back in 67 and 54.
Exactly. So I had pedigree. And for this particular U.S. Open in 1980, the course measured 7,076 yards, played as a par 70.
That's a pretty substantial test. And the field.
Started with 156 players, and after two rounds, 63 guys made the cut. The line was 6 over par, 146.
And just to give a little context for the era, what about the money?
The total prize fund was $356,700. The winner walked away with $55,000. Different times, eh?
Definitely different times. Now, here's where it gets, well, really interesting for me. Despite it being a US Open known for brutal setups.
Right. You expect impossible, rough, rock-hard greens.
Exactly. But some accounts from the time, like Edwin Pope, a respected columnist, describe the conditions as surprisingly manageable. He actually called it the fairest US Open test.
Fairest. Wow. That's not typical U.S. Open language. What did he mean?
Well, he specifically noted the greens were soft as a spaniel's eye for 2 days, which is quite the image.
Yeah, it is.
And the rough was apparently smooth compared with last year at Toledo's Inverness.
Okay, so what does that mean for the players? Softer greens, less punishing rough.
It means they could be more aggressive. Shots into the greens would actually hold, you know? And missing a fairway wasn't an automatic disaster, not a guaranteed punch out or a lost shot like it often is.
So that sounds like a recipe for lower scores then, compared to a typical US Open.
Precisely. Receptive greens, less demanding rough. It really opened the door for players to attack. And that's why we saw some truly remarkable scoring right from the start. And ultimately, a record-breaking win shows how much setup dictates things.
And speaking of remarkable scoring and, defying expectations, you absolutely have to talk about Jack Nicklaus.
Oh, absolutely. He's central to this story. Here he is, 40 years old.
Right. And coming off his first ever professional season without a single win in 1979.
Yeah, the whispers were definitely starting. People were wondering maybe the Golden Bears' best days were behind him.
That was the narrative, for sure. Was his era of dominance finally over?
But then, Thursday morning, first round, he just steps up and bang, shoots a stunning 63, 7 under par.
Which, tied the existing U.S. Open single round scoring record right there. Incredible start.
And wasn't he the only one?
Actually, no. Tom Weisskopf also shot 63 that day, so they shared the record after round one.
Okay, but still, for Nicklaus, given the context, 40 years old, that winless 79 season.
Oh, absolutely. That 63 wasn't just a score. It was a massive statement.
Like the Golden Bear roaring back, telling everyone, I am definitely still here.
Exactly. Think about the psychological impact on him, silencing any doubts he might have had, and on the entire field.
Yeah.
It just completely shifted the story for the week.
It really did. And he backed it up, didn't he? It wasn't just a flash in the pan.
Not at all. He followed that 63 with a solid 71 in round two that gave him the outright lead by 2 shots.
Okay.
Then a 70 in the third round kept him tied for the lead heading into Sunday. And he closed it out with a 68 in the final round for a total of 272.
But he wasn't running away with it, was he? He had someone right there with him.
Oh, yeah. He was locked in this incredible head-to-head battle. And fascinatingly, paired with the same guy for all 4 rounds.
That's unusual. Who was it?
His challenger was someone golf in America hadn't really seen contend like this on this stage before, Isao Aoki of Japan.
Aoki, right. The sources paint him as just phenomenal that week. So consistent.
Unbelievably consistent. His opening rounds were 68, 68, 68.
Wow, 3 straight 68s. That put him tied with Nicklaus after 54 holes.
Exactly. Tied going into Sunday. He shot a 70 in the final round, finished at 274, just 2 strokes back. It was his best finish in a major at that point.
And he picked up, what, just under $30,000 for second place?
Yeah, $29,500. But the really captivating thing about Aoki's performance, according to these sources, was his putting.
Oh, yeah. What was so special?
Get this. He only needed 112 putts over the entire 72 holes.
Wait, 112 for 4 rounds? That's an average of 28 per round. Is that Is that good?
Good. It's astonishing. Edwin Pope wrote that 125 putts for the tournament would have been considered phenomenal back then.
For 112 was just otherworldly.
Completely. Historically great putting. And his style was apparently quite unique, too.
How so?
Described as this club toe up, club heel down putting style.
Huh. Where'd that come from?
Well, the story's pretty cool. He developed it as a young caddy back in Japan. He was using a putter made in the U.S. that was actually too long for him.
So he just kind of adapted.
Yeah.
Made it work.
Yeah. Figured out this unique way to hold it and stroke it. And clearly, it worked incredibly well for him.
That technique, his performance, it really highlights his role in making golf more international, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Here's a player from Japan with, you know, 78 wins worldwide already, stepping onto the biggest stage in the U.S. and going toe-to-toe with Nicklaus. It was a big deal.
And there's that great little anecdote about him too, right? Before the final round.
Oh, yeah, the blackjack story.
Mm-hmm.
The sources mentioned he was playing blackjack with his wife in their hotel room until 2 a.m. the night before the final round.
2 in the morning before the biggest round of his life facing Nicklaus.
Pope called it a titanic turnaround from maybe some wilder days when he was younger. Perhaps it was just his way of coping, you know? Staying relaxed, managing that immense pressure. A very different kind of prep.
Incredible. And that pairing, Nicklaus and Aoki, playing together for all 4 rounds, that must have created such a unique atmosphere.
It really did. You almost never see the final pairing
play
together every single day in a major. It just intensified the duel.
So how did that final round play out between them?
Well, Nicklaus got a slight edge early on. He birdied the 3rd hole, while Aoki bogeyed the 2nd. That created the 2-stroke gap right there, which ended up being the final margin.
But Aoki didn't just fold, did he?
No way. You really see his fight on the 10th hole. Nicklaus hits his approach shot close, looks like a guaranteed birdie.
Pressure's on Aoki.
Right, and Aoki answers by heeling this long putt from just off the green, from the fringe, to match Nicklaus's birdie. Just amazing tenacity.
Wow, and wasn't there some drama late, like on 17?
Oh yeah, the par 3 17th was pure theater.
Yeah.
Nicklaus sinks a 22-foot birdie putt. Huge roar, puts all the pressure back on Aoki.
And Aoki.
He steps up over his putt, about a 5-footer, and just drains it. Matches the birdie. Keeps himself right there. Unbelievable clutch putting from both guys.
Just fantastic stuff. But Nicklaus ultimately sealed it on 18.
He did. Rolled in a 10-foot burst putt on the final hole to put an exclamation point on it.
There's that quote from Aoki afterwards, reflecting on it.
Yeah, it really sums up facing Nicklaus that week. He said something like, "I kept telling myself no matter how perfect he is, he will make a mistake. But I was wrong. Jack did not make any errors."
Until the end of the tournament. And he called it a very good lesson. Just pure respect there.
Incredible respect for Nicklaus, just being relentless, flawless under that pressure.
Now, while that duel was happening, we shouldn't forget some other key moments and players.
Definitely not. Like, remember Tom Weisskopf? He also shot that opening 63.
Right. Tied Nicklaus after day one. But what happened to him?
Well, his next rounds were not so good. A 75 and nothing better than 75 after that first round. He ended up finishing way back in 37th place.
So that really puts Nicklaus's and Aoki's consistency into perspective, doesn't it? Maintaining that level under U.S. Open pressure for 4 days is just incredibly hard.
Exactly. And then there was that shocking moment with Seb Ballesteros.
Oh, yeah. Reigning Masters and British Open champ.
He shot 75 in the first round, which wasn't great, but not out of it. But then he was disqualified because he missed his tee time for the 2nd round.
Just missed his tee time.
Wow. Shows how strict those major championship rules are.
Huh.
Doesn't matter if you're Seb Ballesteros, the hottest player in the world, you miss your time, you're out.
A tough way for a top contender to leave. Any other notable finishers?
Yeah, we had some big names near the top. Keith Fergus, Lon Hinkle, and Tom Watson all tied for 3rd place at 4-under. Watson's presence always added star power.
And a few other past champions hung around, too.
Mm-hmm. Hale Irwin and Andy North, both previous U.S. Open winners, tied for 8th. So a solid leaderboard behind the top 2.
So when we look back, what's the real legacy of this 1980 U.S. Open? What does it all mean?
Well, it's profound, especially for Jack Nicklaus. I mean, at 40, after that winless 79, this victory wasn't just another major title.
No, it felt like more.
It was a massive career resurgence, a genuine second wind, you could say. It completely silenced all those doubters who thought he was done.
Right. And it wasn't like it was his last hurrah either. It seemed to kickstart something.
Exactly. It wasn't an ending. It really felt like a catalyst. This win led to him winning the PGA Championship later that same year, 1980. And, you know, looking further ahead, it set the stage for that unbelievable final major win at the 1986 Masters when he was 46. This U.S. Open proved emphatically that he could still compete and win at the absolute highest level.
And the record book confirms it too, that 272 total.
A new U.S. Open scoring record at the time. And what's just wild is that he broke his own record of 275.
Which he set when?
Back in 1967 on the very same course.
Yeah.
Valdes rolled lower. So he came back 13 years later and beat his own mark. Just incredible. He basically lowered the benchmark for scoring there.
And it was his fourth U.S. Open title, right? Putting him in very rare company.
Extremely rare. Only Willie Anderson, Bobby Jones, and Ben Hogan had won four U.S. Opens before him. So it really cemented his place among the absolute icons of the game.
So Nicholas gets the records, the history. But the enduring memory for many is probably that duel.
Absolutely. That head-to-head with Aizawa Aoki, especially because they were paired together all 4 days, that's what sticks with people.
And Aoki's performance, beyond just the duel, had its own impact.
Definitely. It really underscored the growing strength of international golf. He captivated people. And as we said, Nicklaus's score of 272 set a new standard for Valdes Roll moving forward, impacting how people viewed the course for future majors held there, like the 93 Open or the PGAs in 05 and 16.
So looking back, the 1980 U.S. Open, it really feels like a championship for the ages.
It does. Just a fantastic test of skill, mental strength, featuring a legend's comeback, a brilliant international challenger, records falling, and moments you just don't forget.
Yeah, it really stands up as an iconic week in golf. So diving into these sources today really brought it back to life. Nicklaus's incredible comeback win, Aoki's brilliant and unique challenge, that memorable duel, the records. It's a great reminder, I think, of why looking back at these historical events is so compelling. It helps us understand how the sport evolves and just the pure drama of competition at its best. And it leaves us with maybe an interesting thought to chew on. You know, given those descriptions, we talked about the course being fairer than maybe a typical U.S. Open.
Yeah, the soft greens, the less penal rough.
Right. How much did that specific setup actually contribute to the record scoring we saw, and maybe even the intensity of that duel between Nicklaus and Aoki?
That's a great question. Does a fairer U.S. Open, one where low scores are possible and players can be more aggressive, actually create more exciting golf than the traditional, often brutal test we expect?
What do you think makes for the best kind of major championship challenge? Something to ponder.